Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. They say 50 is the new 30. Well, it's not, by the way. It's just the new 50. But 40 could be the new 30 in the world of work. Amazon is experimenting with a 30-hour work week. The notion is that traditional full-time schedules might not be a great one-size-fits-all model. Well, you forget about 40. Nearly half of American workers say they're putting in more than 50 hours a week on the job. And if you're a fairly low-waged salary worker who doesn't get overtime, things could be changing for you as of December 1st. Let's talk about it after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. We are so glad to have you in the conversation today. We're talking about the world of work and how many hours a week you work. We only work 1 hour a week. Well, 4 hours a week. We work from noon to one, 4 days a week. So pretty much that's it. Right, guys? Four hours. That's it. That's all. But we're wondering what your work schedule is. We're curious about how many hours a week you're working. And how do you define that work? If you answer email at home, do you consider yourself to be working, and do you count those moments in the aggregate? Are you working at more than one job? And how open do you think your company or organization would be to taking a look at possible changes to the 40-hour-a-week model that's guided us really since the Model T days? It was actually Henry Ford who introduced the 40-hour work week, and it was actually a decrease from the then standard 48-hour work week. Back in 1914. We were not on the air that time, by the way. We're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. There was an article in the New York Times about Amazon, a pretty slamming article, and it was very concerning to the folks at Amazon. And essentially, the New York Times described Amazon as a place where employees were encouraged to work up to 80 hours a week and rarely take a vacation. And Amazon said, no, that misrepresents our company. And they have not said whether their latest move is related to that article, but they are now introducing a new pilot program in which some of their employees will be working 30 hours a week instead of 40. They're going to get 75% of the pay of a 40-hour employee and all of the same benefits. They'll work Monday through Friday, 10 to 2, with some flex hours. And so we're wondering what you're thinking about that. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Is there for you a line between work and the rest of life? And or how is that changing in the modern world? Lots of companies certainly now offering a 4-day work week with flexible hours, but most of them still stick to that 40-hour rule. So the thinking at Amazon is that this might really help lure millennials into the workforce, which is a big target for them. And why not? In the sense that millennials really value their work-life balance. In fact, up to 40% of them rank good work-life balance above any other reason to work for an organization. So we're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. You can join us on Twitter at Kathy Lewis Talks, and we're on Facebook as well. Love to hear from you there as well. We're glad to have Scott Beeson with us today. He's a professor of management at Fairleigh Dickinson University, and he's an authority in these work-life issues, and his book is called The Working Dad's Survival Guide. Scott Beeson, thank you for joining us.
No, it's great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have you looked at this Amazon policy and sort of evaluated it from your perspective as somebody who thinks about work-life balance?
Yeah, I absolutely have. And in fact, I wrote an article for Harvard Business Review about this just recently. So yes, I've been doing a lot of thinking. In short, I think these reduced work hour type of accommodations very often don't work out very well because if you have 30-hour-a-week employees mixed in with, quote-unquote, 40-hour-a-week employees who often are working, like, 60, mm-hmm. It really sets up, weird dynamics within your workplace and, subtle pressure for the people who have chosen the reduced work hours to keep working more and more, and also stigmatizes them in the eyes of, in many companies, in the eyes of managers and in the corporate culture as kind of being lesser employees. So very often a 30-hour work week solution like Amazon is experimenting with do not work very well. However, I think Amazon is doing one thing that's really smart that could minimize some of these disadvantages, and that's that they're setting up entire units that are working these 30-hour work weeks together, including the managers. And that should reduce some of those social pressures and stigmas that we see in the workplace with this.
That's an interesting point, and you could be forgiven for thinking that from a management perspective, they're looking at people who are working 40 hours and people who are working 30 hours and maybe making judgments about that. But if everybody's in the same boat, that's sort of a different perspective. We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. How would you like the idea of a 30-hour work week? Now, in the case of Amazon, it's coming with 75% of the pay of a 40-hour work week, too. So that's one factor to consider. Matt's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi there. I only work half-time, just 12 hours a day. And I suppose that's just about every day of the year. But part of it is the space that I'm in. I'm in the startup space. I write computer software. And there's this expectation from external companies, because I do a fair amount of telecommuting, remote software development. And there's an expectation that when they hire you, you're going to work 60 hours a week. And I actually ask that in telephone interviews, just so we're on the same page. Can you tell me, are you expecting that I'll work 40 hours a week or 50 or 60, just so I know what you're expecting?
Sure.
At the same time, I'm developing my own products. And it takes so much time to develop software that if you're not going to pour yourself into it or have a whole lot of help, you just can't you can't get things out in a timely fashion.
Are they honest with you, Matt, when you say, hey,
never.
Are we 40, 50,
never.
60? Never.
Never. They say, well, you know, if you work 50 hours one week, you know, maybe it's or 60, maybe it's okay to work a few hours less the next week.
Really interesting.
If I could jump in a second, that's kind of it's the traditional way of thinking about work is time-based, right? But you're developing software, and you would think that your clients would be concerned about you delivering good work and good software and the correct product on time. And that it shouldn't matter to them if you can accomplish this in 45 hours or in 65 hours a week. So, I mean, this is a mindset that many companies still have. But in today's, you know, as Kathy was mentioning, in today's society, in today's workforce, the line between where and when work gets done has become very blurry. And I think it'd be smarter if people focused more on, hey, you know, what is your work performance going to be, as opposed to how many hours are you spending?
What is your output? What are
work?
You? Yeah, what are you delivering? That's really interesting, Matt. I wonder you. I think you work at home, right? Because you're in software development. So
I do.
That must make it very difficult to maintain those boundaries. And I wonder how you do that.
Well, I don't do a very good job of it, to be honest. you know, on the one hand, I have dinner with my family every night, and I pick my daughter up, you know, when she gets off the bus from school. But on the other hand, I'm working till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Sure, sure.
Well, I'll also just mention.
Yeah. Go ahead, Matt.
When there's no clear metric, you know, if you're laying bricks, you can count the number of bricks you laid and say, well, if you can lay them faster in the same, you know, that's great. But when you're doing stuff that your employer basically doesn't understand the nature of. How do they say, well, okay, he's being productive as a software developer? They don't even know what software development, you know, means or is.
Right, yeah. It's a very interesting point, Matt. I thank you for the call. And it's a great jumping off point for the conversation. So we do have quite a number of people who work at home and are challenged on a daily basis to try to figure out, A, if they want to put that line between work and the rest of life, and B, if they do, how do they do that? We're wondering how you do that today at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Shannon posting on our Facebook page, when I worked at Amazon from September 14 to September 15, it was the worst job I ever had. Working from home, benefits are exceptional, but the climate and system is awful. We worked 40 hours and were encouraged and sometimes mandated to work overtime. So, Scott Beeson, it occurs to me that this post just sort of speaks to that. So much of any change you make in the work scenario, especially if you're talking about folks who report to an office site, you have to really have some cultural conversations and change some culture.
Absolutely. You know, formal policy can only get you part of the way. It has to be kind of the change in mindset. And, you know, the companies that are adapting to it, and I think Amazon might be trying to start their process for adapting to it, but many other companies who are implementing more flexible work hours and embracing more of this culture are doing so only because they see all their good employees leaving becoming disengaged or not choosing to apply to work for them. So for a lot of companies, they're seeing that, you know, they can attract and retain better employees by being more accommodating and more flexible. And hopefully this creates kind of a virtuous cycle where companies start competing for that. But it really takes more than just implementing a policy. I mean, I remember in doing interviews for my book, I was talking to a lot of dads who took paternity leave or didn't take paternity leave. And one was at a company that offered 12 weeks of paid paternity leave. And when he told his boss he wanted to take it, the boss was like, most people take two, and that's about right.
Wow.
And it was very clear he was making the wrong decision culturally, even if it was the, perfectly reasonable decision from a policy point of view.
Really interesting. So there's often a difference, why should this surprise us, in what's written down and what actually happens, because culture, what is it they say, culture eats strategy for lunch. 17 minutes past
absolutely.
The hour.
Great. Yep.
Kenny's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Kenny. You're on the air.
Hi. Culturally, is it possible to get rid of the 40-hour work week period and just probably introduce, instead of 8 hours, we introduce four hours, and, you know, we kind of split the difference with unemployed people that are out there?
I see what you're talking about, Kenny. I thank you for the call. And this is really an interesting point that Kenny makes, because one of the ideas that's been talked about with these crashing together generations in the workplace and the boomers not turning loose of the jobs and the millennials saying, I want to get in there and get a job, is to do sort of, in some respects, what our caller is talking about, Scott Beeson, which is maybe each of them works 30 hours a week.
Yeah, it's kind of a job share type of approach. And, you know, if you go back, to maybe my childhood or even earlier, if we looked at the future and what technology was going to bring, we were promised that technology would make us so productive, everyone could work just a couple hours a day and still, you know, but now it seems to work more, even though technology is substituting for so much of work. So that promise has not come through. But I do sometimes think about with dual career couples, which is much more the norm today. You know, we don't really have the one breadwinner and the one homemaker model much anymore in this country, that a working couple where both parents working outside the home could probably make it work with two-thirds of a job each. But with a full job, and often a full job being 50 or 60 hours a week, both of them doing that makes it really, really hard to really run a functioning family and being the type of parents they want to be. So there's some merit to what our caller just said. I think that would require significant change, though it would be difficult to coordinate, though.
And not to mention the fact that that would have salary implications, just to be very clear.
Again, getting back to Amazon, that's exactly what they're doing. If you're an employee who's doing that, you're trading off some income for time.
Exactly. So, and can we talk for a moment? And I don't know how much you're aware of this, because what I'm reading suggests that not many people are aware of these new overtime rules that are coming into effect on December 1st. Well, I say they're coming into effect. There's an effort to delay them in the Congress. But at the moment, if nothing changes, these new overtime rules will take effect December 1st. So the idea here is that employees, and if you want to think about is an employee who is making under $45,000, something like that, has some management responsibilities, but doesn't make $45,000. So if you made around $23,660, if you make at least that, and you have some managerial responsibilities, you know, like supervisors at fast food restaurants, office administrators, that sort of thing, those folks have typically been allowed to be exempt from overtime. So they do not make a tremendously large wage, and they are sometimes expected to work overtime for which they will not be compensated. So in the looking at that issue, the administration decided to promulgate some rules that will take effect December 1st that essentially doubled that threshold. So now, if you earn less than $47,476 a year and you have those managerial responsibilities that we've described, you will now be eligible for overtime. Lots of folks are happy about this because it puts more money in their pocket. Certainly about 120,000 Virginians anticipated to get pay raises as a result of this. Some businesses are saying, look, that's a huge burden, and we will have to either reduce hours or hire part-timers or something to deal with that change. Scott Beeson, it occurs to me this is a big jump, and we should note that that 23,000 figure is actually below the poverty line for a family of four. So while it's a big jump, it sure sounds like one that that needed a review.
Yeah, you know, it is a big jump. So, you know, I do have sympathy for employers that this is kind of a big change for them. However, it might have been better if this had been tracked with cost of living or something like that over a period of time, right? And then it would be a less dramatic change. It would be something that would be gradually adjusted every few years. And I think that's what the plan is going forward, by the way. So we won't be in quite this position again. But just as you described, so most hourly employees get overtime. That's just part of their deal. And it's if you have managerial responsibilities or other quote-unquote professional type of work, you're often exempt from overtime, because, if you're a manager making big bucks and you're responsible for, a division of your company, well, if you have to work more than 40 hours a week, that's part of the deal. But, this really gets, to what you were saying, to a lot of frontline supervisors who maybe don't make a lot of money but are often asked to or forced to work exceeding hours. From my point of view, I think this rule change makes some sense in that if you're giving someone a lot of responsibility that requires them to work consistently more than 40-hour weeks, they should either get a salary that's commensurate with their responsibilities, or they should be eligible for overtime if you're going to, on occasion, ask them to extend themselves. And so it seems like a rule that makes sense to me, but I do understand the disruption of the pretty severe jump.
The timetable was intense. Sure, the timetable was intense. We're at 23 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. If you are an exempt employee making under that threshold that we've described, which is 47,000 and change, we're wondering whether you are aware, 47,476 to be exact, we're wondering whether you're aware of this and whether you have gotten a recent pay raise to accommodate that. That seems to be the way that a lot of employers are approaching this, just bring the salary up to that level and then continue to anticipate overtime, but no overtime pay. But we're wondering what that experience is for you. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240 are the numbers where you can join us today. Scott Beeson, it seems to me we talked a bit about culture, so critically important, and we've also talked about evaluation or the idea of management looking at somebody who works fewer hours, maybe not taking them quite as seriously from a promotion career track perspective as somebody who's working more hours. There's some really interesting ideas around newer management techniques that take us away from this annual performance review, the one time in the year that you sit down with somebody to take a look at your performance, and really attempt to make this a more organic day-to-day process. And I know you've been doing some reading and writing about that.
Yeah, I think that's critically important. And actually, performance evaluation is probably the thing managers do the worst out of their many tasks that they're responsible for. And it makes sense because it's uncomfortable to sit down and then tell somebody what they're not doing well. So managers avoid it or they don't really do a comprehensive job on it. But if, yeah, so if it, instead of being this dreaded annual process, it becomes more of your day-to-day coaching, that every 2 weeks you have a 10, 15 minutes sit down with your employee talking about what they're working on, what help they need, how they're doing, that makes a lot of sense. We have big companies like Accenture and Deloitte, who, instead of annual performance reviews, they're building in kind of a review cycle at the end of different projects. So at the end of working on a project for a client, everyone gets together and debriefs about how the project went and how each individual performed during that project, and then what maybe development plans we need going forward. So companies are starting to catch on with this, and some companies have gone so far that they just track a couple of key metrics and they don't go through the bother of having formal performance reviews at all. But again, this goes back to the point I made before with the first caller, who very eloquently was saying that he feels like he's being asked to work so many hours, regardless of his productivity. And, you know, if we're really trying to measure performance and productivity, we should measure performance and productivity and not use, you know, the amount of time you spend in the office as like a proxy for that.
Interesting point. And we're also wondering today at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240, how you are doing on the emailing in the off hours. What does that look like to you? I think it's France, if I'm not mistaken, where they're actually sort of having policies that say you cannot email after hours because they sort of are now considering that a part of work. And Scott Beeson, this is interesting too, because there seems to be a bit of a shift. I was talking to somebody the other day who said that in their company, it is not they're looking at the boss, and the boss is walking out at the end of the workday, and not staying all hours and the rest of it. So a piece of this is about modeling what I suspect we're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this gets to culture. I mean, culture is what people see and what they you know, what they experience more so than what a policy is. So, yeah, if a manager is kind of role model, if the manager is emailing people at 11 o'clock at night and expecting a quick response, you know, they could talk all they want to about work-life balance or about, you know, reasonable work hours and expectations. But, you know, obviously late-night expectations to stay connected to the office are getting communicated, right? So it's important that managers do this. And in fact, you know, again, one of the dads that I interviewed was a kind of a mid to upper level manager. And he was on days he coached his son's little league, he left at 3:30. And he didn't make a big deal of it. He didn't announce it. But he didn't apologize for it. You know, he checked in with his team earlier in the afternoon and made sure everybody had what they needed. He said he would check in after his kids were in bed, like 10 o'clock at night, for half an hour. So look at his emails and only respond to emergencies that couldn't wait till the next morning. And that's how he operated. And that gave everyone, not just him, but gave everyone a little more confidence that they could do similar things for their work.
Interesting. We've also posted on our Facebook page a memo from November of 2014 from Vice President Biden. And he says, to my wonderful staff, I would like to take a moment and make something clear to everyone. I do not expect, nor do I want any of you to miss or sacrifice important family obligations for work. And then he goes on to list everything, first communions, anniversaries, bar mitzvahs, graduation. This is very important to me. In fact, I will go so far as to say that if I find out that you are working with me while missing important family responsibilities, it will disappoint me greatly. This has been an unwritten rule since my days in the Senate. Thank you for all the hard work. 29 minutes past the hour. So this gets to this point where these things have to be communicated. If there's a change or if there's an expectation, sometimes that's where a conversation is really helpful. And if you work in such an organization, maybe you just go to the boss and say, hey, what are your expectations around this? And if they're different than you think they are, maybe other people have that misunderstanding as well. And it's helpful sometimes to communicate that across the system. Larry is on the line from Chesapeake. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. How are you?
All right.
I have just recently retired and took a part-time job, and I'm topped out at 30 hours because they would have to pay benefits federally beyond that. And I'm wondering if these folks drop their hours to 30 hours, will they lose their benefits?
As at least in the Amazon example, and Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, but they are maintaining the full-time benefit structure for those folks. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And Larry, thank you for the call. There is some concern, though, speaking of benefits, with these new overtime rules. There is some concern because what's happening in some cases is that some employers are reclassifying employees. So you may go from a non-exempt employee back to an hourly employee, and you may have very different benefit structures there for exempt employees and hourly employees. So that is definitely something to keep an eye on if you are working in a company and you're making under, particularly if you're exempt, and you're making under that $47,476 level. Again, these rules are expected to go into place December 1st, but there is a big conversation right now about delaying the rollout or stretching out the rollout. So we'll keep you posted on that.
But the last caller, while it's true for Amazon that they're maintaining their benefits, there is no obligation to do so for employees who work less than 30 hours a week.
Ah, it's a great point.
So that's what he was referring to. Mm-hmm. So, and that was one of the concerns with the Affordable Care Act, was that they would limit employees to less than 30 hours a week, so they wouldn't have to extend them health insurance.
29 minutes before the hour, Stephen's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I feel that businesses who have managerial staff and they don't want to pay them as much, I feel that they should have to pay the societal costs for taking their employees out of more than a regular work week and have to actually pay them overtime. And I don't think Congress should really fight about rolling out, even though businesses will lobby for slowing down or halting any rollout of the new overtime rules.
So you say bring it on.
Bring it on. Businesses have to be able to pay their employees for the time that they're there working. And if they're not willing to, then you either have to go somewhere else where somebody's going to pay you, or there needs to be an environmental change for the business environment.
Stephen, it's a very interesting point. It reminds me that in America, we sort of have a different view of work than many countries around the world. And Scott Beeson, going back to Matt's call, and Stephen underscores this, there is, in many cases, this sort of unwritten expectation that you're going to work some overtime.
Yeah, I think for people who want upwardly mobile careers, particularly in quote-unquote professional capacities, I think it's part of the deal, and I don't know if it's necessarily a terrible thing that people have, are expected, at least at some points in their career, to really push in to get ahead. But I think people should be compensated for it, echoing what the caller just mentioned. I also, just want to, a pattern that I've seen is that whenever there are kind of work changes to the workplace being legislated, for example, paid family leave, like in California, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island, initially the business lobbies are lined up completely against it. But then we see in California, for example, 10 years after they implemented paid family leave, over 90% of businesses now support it. And so I think a similar thing will happen with these new overtime rules is that companies will make the adjustment, and then they'll see, that wasn't quite as bad as we expected. Life goes on, business goes on. It's not the worst thing in the world that I'm paying my very important frontline supervisors a better salary, or that I converted them back to hourly, and now I can go with regular overtime rules when I need them to go overtime. I just think it won't be quite as large a change for most employers than they're anticipating at the moment.
Interesting. Brian is on the line from Suffolk. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
Great conversation. I have been on both sides of the coin as a restaurant manager. I worked sometimes near 80 hours a week, and I was on salary, and it wasn't long before I kind of figured out that if you write the word salary down and slavery down and draw a line to like letters, they're pretty much the same word. I work in the federal government now, and we are, I know it's different from for different sections of the federal government, but when we work past our 40, we cannot claim overtime. In fact, we do what's called credit hours, and we can only have 21 hours of credit on the books, and anything over that, you just lose. And so you have to be very mindful of how you put on your the time on your timesheet and then how you burn that time, or you actually end up losing it. But, you know, I am glad to have a job.
Sure, I hear you. Brian, yeah, it's a great point. Yeah, that's a great point. Thank you for the call. And certainly, I think a lot of supervisors at this moment are going over those overtime rules to adjust their employees, their staffers, times to accommodate this new scenario. Mario's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Mario. You're on the air.
Hello, Kathy.
Hi.
Hope you're doing fine.
I am well. How about you?
I'm fine. I'm a maintenance man, so I work 7 days a week and get 40 hours a week. But if they were to cut back on the hours, you know, that's less money coming in for these families. And like me, I get Social Security, so, you know, I can't really afford less hours than 40 a week with a family of three and a wife and rent and everything else, you know. But how is this going to affect the insurance if I got a roommate that stays here and he's working right at 40 hours, but the company doesn't pay for insurance. Mm. He don't have to because under 40 hours is considered part time.
Yeah, and I
Go
ahead, Mara. So you're concerned about the insurance, and I want to ask you one quick question before we sort of talk a bit about that. You said you're a maintenance guy. You're working 7 days a week.
Yes, ma'am.
Pretty much 40 hours. So, are you working really more than 40 hours, or do you just spread that out over those 7 days?
Well, I kind of spread it out, but most part, I work well over that because I'm on 24-hour call. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, I'm used to this. I'm 67 years old, and, you know, I work a lot of, hours, and I don't really mind the hours that I work. I got great boss, but I don't get no insurance. I got insurance through the VA.
Got it.
There's so many people that I meet that are working 30 hours a week. Their rent's under 700, and they can barely make it. Their wives work a job and a half. They got to work a job and a half. They got kids. You know.
Yeah.
How can our economy or our government justify 30 hours a week unless they're going to compensate for what you're missing?
Got it. I hear what you're saying, Mario, and I really appreciate the call. I think this change and this dramatic increase in the threshold for exempt employees is a piece of trying to get at that issue of how hard people are having to work to basically make ends meet. Scott Beeson, there is so much in Mario's call here. First of all, he said he works 40 hours, and then when you really kind of press him a little bit, it's more than 40 hours.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's available 24/7, it sounds like. So that's, you know, even if maybe in a certain week he's only working 40 hours a week, he still kind of always has to be at the ready.
Right.
And, you know, that's labor. And valuable labor in and of itself, right? Secondly, you know, a lot of what when professors like me talk about work-life balance, and, you know, when I work with companies, they're very often large financial firms and things like that. You know, we sometimes forget that really the struggles between, you know, providing for your family and then being able to spend enough time with them really falls much harder on people who are hourly employees, and people all along the economic spectrum. And, You know, I think, you know, being a business school professor kind of puts me in an interesting place, because professors tend to be liberal and business school people tend to be conservative. So it gives me this mix of views where, you know, I think we need to do a lot to be more employer-friendly and business-friendly in society, but I also think at the same time we need to build kind of a better safety net for exactly the kind of people that, this caller was mentioning. I think, you know, our mix of policies in the government right now are kind of an odd alignment. And, you know, we're over-regulated in some places and under-regulated in others. And, you know, it'd be nice if we can kind of start from scratch maybe with a system that works a little better, both for the employers who are taking on the risk and are employing people, and then the employees who, are the heart of business,
sure,
and also our citizens who, you know, we need to provide for, these basics like insurance and the rest.
Mario, you are a hardworking man, and I appreciate everything that you're doing, and I really appreciate your perspective on this today, because I think you are like a lot of people who are trying to figure out what these implications are, and who are working probably well beyond the 40 and at the on call all the time too, which has its own particular stress to it, I suppose. Mario, thank you for joining us today.
Sure. You have a blessed day.
You too. Take care. That's Mario on the line from Virginia Beach with concerns about insurance, and talking about the people that he talks to are really working hard to put things together. Scott Beeson, thank you so much for joining us today from Fairleigh Dickinson University. And I hope people will buy your book, The Working Dad's Survival Guide, because everybody's in this now, aren't they?
Absolutely. And, yeah, we tend to think about work-family balance as a woman's issue, but really it affects everyone. It's a family issue. It's a societal issue. And, it'd be great if both men and women are supported in, trying to succeed in their careers and be the type of parents they really want to be.
Fair enough. And thank you for joining us at 18 minutes before the hour. That's Scott Beeson from Fairleigh Dickinson, where he's a professor of management. You know, to that point of both parents often being in the workplace, going back to Amazon for a minute, one of the issues they're having is that they're trying to get more women into management. Right now they have 76% of their management team is men, so they're trying to get more women into management. And that, candidly, is one of the hopes of this 30-hour week experiment, is to try to see if they can't make it more attractive for women who, despite change, are still sort of dealing with the majority of what goes on at home as well. So we'll see how that works, and we'll keep checking back in on that. We're at, call it about 17 before the hour. Glad to have Dr. Robert Verona with us today. He's a professor at Eastern Virginia Medical School, and he's the medical director of the EVMS Sleep Disorder Clinic. Dr. Verona, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We are talking a lot in this program about working and about sort of working around the clock. And we know that given the number of people who are working in a gig economy and part-time jobs trying to put it together, there's an awful lot of shift work happening 24 hours a day. I wonder what the research shows in terms of impacts of that kind of shift work on our bodies.
Well, I think, we are meant biologically to sleep at night and be up during the day. But as you know, and you've discussed, roughly 20% of the population, adult population, does shift work. And for those who work, for example, at night, they tend to get less sleep. Their sleep is of lesser quality. They are oftentimes more apt to be sleepy during the day. So there are indeed consequences for trying to fight biology, if you will.
I thought it was interesting, too. They've done some intriguing studies on productivity and sleep and hours worked, and essentially it looks like, if I've got this right, the less sleep you get and the more hours you work, the less productive you are. I think I've got that right.
Well, I think that there was a big study out of the University of Pennsylvania that showed that the biggest culprit, if you will, for getting less sleep was the amount of hours you worked. And there's no question that if we get less sleep, there are a myriad of consequences. You know, it's pretty clear. I guess nobody can really tell you that there's this unified or one reason we sleep. But We do know now that sleep is important for memory and learning. It's important for mood and cognition, for performance. It's important for your immune system. And we know that with less sleep, you're more apt to have obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease. So it would make perfect sense that the bill would come due from the standpoint of one's work productivity in a number of ways if you don't get sufficient sleep.
We're at 15 minutes before the hour, and we'd love to hear from you today if you are such a shift worker. Maybe you are. I've been driven recently with an Uber driver in another city who was telling me that he works a couple of hours every night, and then he goes to a midnight job, and then he has another job around noon the next day. I don't know how he's doing it. 440-26651, 800-940-2240. Dr. Verona, I wonder, there's always debate about this, and I wonder what your perspective is on the amount of uninterrupted sleep we need in a night and whether that's the same for everybody.
Well, a couple things. I think most would agree that the average adult needs between 7 and 9 hours. I think most of us say 7 to 8 hours of sleep per 24-hour period. You know, the National Sleep Foundation actually came out with recommendations within the last year, and our own Dr. Ware, the division chief here at EVMS, was one of this 18-member panel that opined on this. But, you know, there's tremendous differences depending on age. But for most adults, I'm going to say most of us need about 7 to 8 hours of sleep. Now, can there be variability amongst adults and what they need? Of course there can be. You know, there's certainly a bell curve. But one of the things that's interesting here at the Sleep Disorder Center at EVMS is to talk to folks who say, oh, I only need 5 or 6 hours of sleep, and I do just fine. I think, for the most part, that's not true. Most of us, if we only get 5 or 6 hours of sleep in a 24-hour period, will be impaired in a number of possible ways, whether it's mood, cognitive capabilities, or performance. The short answer to that is most adults require, say, 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night to be at their best.
And, you know, we know there are rather notoriously a couple of modern catastrophes that have been attributed to human fatigue. The Space Shuttle Columbia is one. The crash of the Exxon Valdez is another. 13 minutes before the hour, we're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. You know, I know that there are operations that have to be working 24 hours a day, public safety, hospitals, and the like. How, if you were to advise, based on your knowledge of sleep and what you're seeing in your clinic, if you were to advise companies that have 24-hour-a-day operations about how to do this in the most humane and maximally productive way from a scheduling perspective, what advice would you give them?
Well, I think that I'd make a few recommendations. Number one, I think I would tell them to remember the fact that we human beings do not adapt quickly to changes in our wake and sleep time. So in other words, just because I ask you to shift from working 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. Doesn't mean that your body will agree with that immediately. So they have to understand that the human body will only slowly entrain to those sorts of changes, and they need to be cognizant of that. I think they're probably better off having folks have relatively longer periods on a specific shift. So don't have somebody change shifts every few days, but have them work for longer periods of time. It could be a month at a time. It could be more permanent if workers will allow that. I think they're better off there. I think to the extent that they can make the work environment light so that it's alerting, that can also help, that they educate their workers to the fact that they need to protect their sleep during the day to make the home bedroom environment dark, quiet, cool, uninterrupted, so they sleep better at night. I think that's going to help them function better too. They also need to recognize the fact that there are differences in individuals as far as how they do with night shift work. So, for example, if you know, we've all heard about morning larks and night owls. Well, night owls tend to do better with night shift work. Whether they're going to be able to select those people, I don't know, but that's a possibility. And perhaps going forward down the line, when we know more about genetics and circadian rhythms and, you know, who can work better at night, we can use that sort of testing to select. We can't do that now. So those are some things I'd recommend.
That's very
I try and make the work environment as friendly as possible for being alert at night, and then educate the workers carefully so they know what they can do to optimize their sleep during the day.
Really interesting. And I saw online the other day a desk that actually has a bed underneath embedded in it, like so you can take a nap in the middle of the day, which I know mm-hmm. there's a lot of thought about that as well. So, that sort of, to me, when I looked at that, I thought, oh my gosh, I think that just speaks so many volumes, I can't even handle it. Dr. Robert Verona, thank you for being with us from the EVMS Sleep Disorder Center. Very much appreciate it today.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Take care. Laurel is on the line from Hampton. Hi, Laurel. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to say, but you know what? When you're talking about doing shifts, mm-hmm. what happened, like before, I know when I was growing up, they had, if they were 24-hour shifts, if you worked like the midnight shift, you know, you got more money. Mm-hmm. And why can't they go back to that and actually companies being fair to employees? I grew up working in the 70s.
Yeah.
Where I always, my jobs, I got insurance, even waitress jobs. Some of them I had insurance, and if I didn't, I could afford to buy insurance.
Boy, Laurel, I remember those days as well. I started work in the 70s, and I can remember when they calculated our pay packets. They said, oh, but you have this salary and this insurance. And as a very young woman, I can remember thinking, well, that doesn't count. That's not money. That's not money in my pocket. What difference does that make? Boy, you know, you fast forward a couple decades and you can really see what difference that makes. Laurel, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Wish I could have better news on that, but it's a new and different world, and we're adjusting to a lot of issues like globalization and changing attitudes. And changing methods of work and changing product lines as well. Heard an interesting piece this morning on how gross domestic product may change depending on the kind of work that we do. So it's all sort of interrelated. I thank you for the call today from Hampton. We're going to wrap up today with our good friend Mal Vincent. And this is very interesting. He has a look back at the movie Magnificent Seven. Some of you will remember that. The remake now in theaters. And he was talking today about the Norfolk man who was the art designer on the classic Magnificent Seven.
That's the famous movie music from one of the most famous westerns that ever hit movie screens. And yes, The Magnificent Seven Ride Again, currently on local movie screens. But here's something for you in the Did You Know category. Did you know that the original Hollywood production of The Magnificent Seven was designed by a longtime Norfolk resident who at one time was a leading force in an effort to bring theater to downtown Norfolk? It's true. The current Magnificent Seven is not as good as the 1960 original, which starred Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen, and has become even more famous because of its music by Elmer Bernstein and its stylish look with a set designed in Mexico by Norfolk resident Edward Fitzgerald, who lived here for some 20 years. Edward Fitzgerald came to Norfolk in 1977 with his wife, the playwright Paula Fitzgerald, and took up residence in a luxurious apartment within the ruins of the abandoned Colonial Theater on Tazewell Street. He renamed it the Corinthian as a potential home for his own theater. That theater at one time was the home of people like Eddie Cantor, Mae West, Fritz Kreisler, Yasha Heifetz, and Al Jolson. They all appeared there. But Fitzgerald was interested only in new theater. He was a real gentleman, dressed to the nines every time he went out, and so quiet that we didn't know for years that he had an illustrious past in Hollywood. He worked with Orson Welles on The Lady from Shanghai, Susan Heywood and Gary Cooper on The Garden of Evil. But of course, his most famous credit was the 1960 movie The Magnificent Seven, for which he built an entire village in a remote woods of Mexico. There was something of a hoopla when Fitzgerald was not nominated for an Oscar, but actually the people back in Hollywood thought that that was not a set. They thought it was a real town. The only building that was originally there was the church at the end of the street. during the filming, Fitzgerald was a good friend of Yul Brynner, which meant he was not a good friend of Steve McQueen. Yul was a star, an Academy Award winner already for The King and I, and he had it written into his contract that he was the leader of the Magnificent Seven at all times, and that Steve McQueen and the rest were to stay behind him. Steve McQueen often would break forward and claim it was his horse's fault. No matter, Yul Brynner had those scenes cut.
Are there anything lined up? I did hear of a job below the border shooting some flies away from a village, but I can't find out what it pays.
$20.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Looking for men right now. How many you got?
The new film has Denzel Washington in the lead with Chris Pratt in parallel to the Steve McQueen role.
Man carries a gun, he tends to use it.
Dan, you dead? Pity.
I had just ordered a drink from that man.
The new film gives up the Mexican setting and was filmed near Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Eli Wallach's Mexican bandit has been replaced by an American businessman.
I'm going after off all of you bogues.
Looking for some men to join me.
Is there money in it?
Woo!
How many you got so far?
By the way, one of the most tricky trivia questions to go along with naming the seven reindeer or the seven dwarfs is to name the original seven. Can you name them? Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Horst Buchholz, James Coburn, Brad Dexter, Charles Bronson, and Robert Vaughn. Right on, guys. The Western is not yet dead, and Norfolk had a part in one of the greats. Fitzgerald never made another film to compare with The Magnificent Seven, but the current remake only emphasizes the originality of his work on the 1960 classic.
Brilliant, brilliant. That is the quintessential Western song, isn't it? It really is. I tell you, I just feel like we should load up the Conestogas and head out, right? I mean, that's what that makes you feel like. Or maybe we should load up the Conestogas and try to get over the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel. Who knows? By the way, speaking of transportation, Transportation Secretary Aubrey Lane will be joining us next week on the broadcast. I'm telling you, we have been kicking it up large in terms of our broadcasts here in the last couple of weeks. I hope you have noticed. Great election programming. Great, interesting conversation. So we'll talk with him next week about that. By the way, next week as well, we're going to be talking about light rail in Virginia Beach, some ad campaigns that have people very, very concerned. We're going to talk about that next week as well. And of course, the conversation always continues on Twitter. Speaking of work, that's a 24-hour thing. It's at Kathy Lewis Talks. You can also log on to our website, our Facebook page, and leave your comments there as well. So, what we have coming up, what do we have coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15? I think I have yesterday's listings. Let me check that out for you real quickly. That's how you know it's live, my friends. Lots going on around town this weekend that I hope you'll be able to take advantage of. We always love to hear from you. It's hearsay at WHRV.org. Hearsay at WHRV.org. And a point on that, when you send us your show ideas, be sure to let us know if it's something that's timely that you really want us to consider in a short time frame. That's always very, very helpful. Tonight on WHRO TV 15, it's A Chef's Life. And Vivian returning to work after a summer away from the restaurant. And then at 9:30, it's Movable Feast with Fine Cooking. And so we'll look forward to all of that tonight on WHRO TV 15. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's Thursday, which makes it our Friday. I want to thank our great staff and our interns, and we will see you right back here on Monday. Don't miss it.